Welcome to the Psychology Podcast, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. I'm Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. So today it's a great honor to have Steven Pinker on the podcast. Dr. Pinker is an experimental psychologist who conducts research in visual cognition, psycholinguistics, and social relations. He grew up in Montreal and earned his BA from McGill and his PhD from Harvard. Currently Johnston Professor of Psychology at Harvard, Pinker has also taught at Stanford and MIT. He has won numerous prizes for his research, his teaching, and his 10 books, including The Language Instinct, How the Mind Works, The Blank Slate, The Better Angels of Our Nature, The Sense of Style, and most recently, Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. Pinker is an elected member of the National Academy of Sciences, a two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist, a Humanist of the Year, a recipient of 9 honorary doctorates, and one of Foreign Policy's World's Top 100 Public Intellectuals, and Time's 100 Most Influential People in the World Today. He is chair of the Usage Panel of the American Heritage Dictionary, and writes frequently for the New York Times, The Guardian, and other publications. Steven, great to have you on the show today.
Thank you, Scott.
Oh boy. So to say I've been following your work for almost my whole life is no overstatement. You know, you really influenced me a lot pre my career. You know, I remember reading your How the Mind Works, actually devouring How the Mind Works in the back seat of my parents' car when I was a teenager, and really feeling when I read your book as though I understood how the mind works. And watching the development of your career and your thinking and writing, it seems to me like there's a real common thread. Although your scope of import seems to widen, but it seems like this common thread is sort of an understanding of our common humanity or our common heritage, evolutionary heritage. You know, there was a humanism in How the Mind Works, right?
There is. My broadest concern is human nature and its implications, and recognizing that human nature is universal is a foundation for humanism, that is, in valuing human well-being, human flourishing as the ultimate moral good.
Yes, I think we're both agreed on that. And this idea of human flourishing is something that goes well beyond just happiness. And you make that clear in your new book, Enlightenment Now, when you talk about happiness, that flourishing incorporates lots of things. What are some of the main essential elements of flourishing in your view?
Yes, in fact, a happiness researcher gave me a hard time for not just defining human well-being in terms of happiness, which is the easiest thing to measure, but I meant to expand it to include other things that we deem worthwhile, such as raising children, which can make people less happy in real time, such as accomplishing something like writing a book. I'd be the first to acknowledge that the process of writing a book leads to many moments of unhappiness, but I never regret doing it, just as people seldom regret having children. But creating works of lasting value, helping people other than oneself, making discoveries that benefit humanity, then there are things other than having a smile on your face that we deem worthy of human striving.
Absolutely. And not only in terms of that, but in terms of looking at the course of human history and seeing what has improved, what hasn't improved, some things that we think we will improve are going to increase happiness don't necessarily increase or increase flourishing, for instance. Like you talk about economic inequality, for instance, in your book as something that doesn't necessarily equate to increased flourishing. Is that right?
That's right. In general, people are happier when they are more prosperous. Obviously, many exceptions, but richer countries are happier on average, and more prosperous people within countries are happier on average. Although we know that that's only one of the components of subjective well-being. Others include social trust, freedom, and other intangibles. Inequality has a complicated relationship to subjective well-being. For a while, it was thought that the more unequal the society, the less happier its people were on average, presumably because no matter how well off people are, they're always comparing themselves to others. And if a gap between the average and the best off increases, according to this way of thinking, then even if people were materially better off, they might be less happy. The more recent data suggests that probably isn't true, that what tends to incur people's resentment is not so much inequality per se as a sense of unfairness. They feel that that they're living in a society that is meritocratic and that they have a chance of getting ahead, or even that the rewards are distributed impartially, they can live with inequality. Think there are opportunities for their kids to get ahead and that the evidence is that other people are getting richer, then they feel just fine about their life situation. But if they feel they're trapped, that's what leads to less happiness. The reason that it's been hard to tease them apart is that across societies, lots of good things tend to go together. And this was as a social scientist, this is a constant frustration in trying to disentangle cause and effect.
Yeah, tell me about it. You wrote that in a different context when you used to write about G, or general intelligence. You know, that's a hard one as well, right? You don't cover that too much in your current book, but, you know, I think that's kind of an extension. It's a similar problem, right?
It kind of is. Yeah. And no one's given a single letter to the phenomenon that in many ways, Sweden is a much more pleasant place to live than Somalia, for example. But a lot of good things go together. Some countries are richer. They are better educated. They are have greater gender equality. They're more tolerant of minorities and gay people. And they tend to be more equal. And so in a correlation across countries, what looks like a benefit to equality can just be a benefit of sheer prosperity. I mean, Norway is not just egalitarian. It's rich. And if you try to tease apart the wealth and the equality, then it's often wealth that actually pushes the happiness around more than inequality. But anyway, that's a subject of one of the chapters in the book.
Absolutely. And you also talk about increases in autonomy and sort of the implications of that. That doesn't always necessarily lead to increased happiness. You say some things about, like, you know, increased autonomy for women, which I think is undeniably a good thing. That the definition of belongs as progress doesn't necessarily increase happiness among women, right?
Yes, and one of the great paradoxes of happiness research, which you have written about as well, is that strangely, over the last several decades, in the United States, happiness for women has gone down a little bit. Happiness in other advanced democracies for women has pretty much flatlined, even though happiness for men has increased slightly on average. The paradox is that this is an era in which women have far more opportunities than their mothers and grandmothers did. Opportunities in the workplace, opportunities for self-expression, economic opportunities. But it hasn't on average made women happier. And it may be that as women have greater opportunities, greater freedom, they set higher goals for themselves. And indeed, if you ask men and you ask women to list their life priorities, you know, men in many ways are rather simple creatures. They want professional success. They want a family. We're simple organisms. Women are more complex. Women list among their life priorities all the things men list. But in addition, things like a responsible member of their community and effecting positive social change, and place an even higher value than men on being a good parent, being a good family member. So there's just an awful lot of things that women today strive for, and that's an awful lot of ways of being frustrated, possibly. And that might account for the paradox that as women's autonomy and freedom have expanded, their happiness has not increased.
Yeah. I'm really glad that you lay out a lot of these nuances in your book. It was really helpful for me as a well-being researcher, you know, to distinguish between happiness and meaning and autonomy and happiness, etc. So that was really helpful for me. So here's a quote from your book. "The story of human progress is truly heroic. It is glorious. It is uplifting. It is even, dare I say, spiritual." So first of all, why dare I say? I know why, but I want to hear it from your mouth.
Yes. I argue that endorsing the Enlightenment worldview means rejecting anything supernatural, spirits, and gods, and karma, and destiny, and ghosts and souls and so on, that we live in a natural world governed by physical law, and that no real good comes from thinking about an afterlife or a divine punisher or a rewarder. But of course, one could define spirituality in a psychological sense, namely some sense that we have of awe, of appreciation, of a perception of processes and forces that are bigger than ourselves. And I wrote that passage to counter an accusation that humanism, namely an attempt to make humanity as a whole better off, is somehow boring or bourgeois or materialistic or tepid or arid, that we can't be truly fulfilled unless we believe in a protector in the sky or myths of heroic ancestors or something transcendent, something beyond life on Earth. And I suggest that there is a way of looking at Human Progress that looks at the massive reduction of suffering that we've accomplished, at the hope for still more reductions in suffering, the attempt to understand the cosmos, including our place in it, the attempt to create works of beauty and value that are spiritual in the best sense, but that don't involve any ghosts or spirits or anything supernatural.
Yeah, you know, this idea of the psychology of self-transcendence is a fascinating field and one that I've been doing some work with David Yaden on. And, you know, there's no reason to say that the instinct or the delight we get from that feeling of self-transcendence isn't something that's hardwired into us, something that didn't evolve itself, that is maybe in itself non-reducible to other aspects of our human nature. When I read your book, it seemed, I felt as though this book was the most romantic of all of your books so far. This progression, this interesting, you know, controversy you got into with How the Mind Works when you refer to music as auditory cheesecake, and then people took that to mean that therefore music can be reduced 100% to language, you know, and that's, you know, I think you would say that's not what that means. Even if it was a byproduct, even if it evolved as a byproduct of another module or function, doesn't mean that that in itself shouldn't be appreciated. But you obviously, some critics took it that way. But here's a quote from your new book, which makes me think that maybe while you might not have changed that view, you write more about how enriching these experiences are in themselves. So for instance, you say the arts are one of the things that make life worth living, enriching human experience with beauty and insight. I mean, that's a very romanticism kind of line.
Well, in fact, it's completely consistent with the analysis of music and how the mind works.
Sure.
Maybe I should have called it cheesecake. Maybe I should have called it tiramisu or something more expensive.
That's the thing. Yeah, I think so.
I came from a generation where cheesecake was like the ultimate luxury. In the 1970s, there was a big cheesecake craze. Mm. And it was considered kind of the height of Epicurean discernment to savor the right kind of cheesecake rather than the wrong kind of cheesecake.
Was that in Canada?
No, back in Cambridge, Massachusetts, it was, people of my generation might remember, you go to, you know, dinner parties and people say, oh, you tried the cheesecake at Baby Watson? Oh, no, it's not as good as the cheesecake at Rosie's. And it was a kind of form of Epicurean one-upmanship, the most refined, exquisite cheesecake. But in any case, the two statements are actually completely compatible because one of the reasons I did choose, admittedly, the somewhat shocking metaphor, cheesecake for music, precisely to underscore that we should not confuse evolutionary adaptation in Darwin's sense, the literal sense of some feature that makes the bearer of that feature have more surviving babies. That is not the same as human worth. In fact, often there are cross purposes. Reading, for example, is just not something we were evolutionarily prepared to do. Couldn't be because it's so recent in our evolutionary history, but it's obviously one of the things that make life worth living. On the other hand, blood revenge, the idea that if someone hurts a member of your family, you should kill a member of their family, or if someone insults you, you should lash out violence to establish your credibility. That probably is an adaptation, but it is certainly not something to celebrate. The more we repress it, the better. So the idea of that whole analysis was just to say that it's natural to confuse the two senses of adaptive, namely the biologist's technical sense of a trait that increases fitness, where fitness means number of surviving offspring, and adaptiveness in the sense of what is healthy, valuable, worth maximizing.
That's a great distinction. And the other relevant distinction to me seems to be the distal versus proximal one. You know, some people can take what you're saying as the only things that in our current lifetime, everything we do in our current lifetime is explained. Our actions, our immediate actions are explained based on the actions of our ancestors, which is not true. You know, that's maybe why we have free will in a sense, but I mean, we shouldn't get into the whole free will thing, but you know what I'm saying.
Oh, I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah. Oh, you put your finger on the key reason that evolutionary psychology is so misunderstood and often reviled. Mm-hmm. It's a tempting fallacy to confuse you identify them as the proximate and ultimate levels.
Yeah.
But another way of thinking about it is the psychological level, what we actually experience, what are our thoughts, our drives, our feelings, our motives, our brain processes, versus an evolutionary explanation, namely, why do we have those feelings in the first place? And the reason they're so easily confused is that the process of natural selection can often be metaphorically described as genes being selfish, trying to make as many copies of themselves as possible. And if you slip into that language, even though it can simplify the process, it's easy then to confuse it with the actual motives of the human being that was shaped by those genes. But they're very different. The metaphorical motives of the genes and the real motives of the people. Again, the ultimate versus proximate levels. And if you confuse them, then you'll be baffled by statements like, well, if sexuality is a way to reproduce, why would anyone ever use contraception? Mm-hmm. Isn't that a paradox? Well, it's not a paradox because explanations apply to different levels. The sexual desire is something that we describe at a proximate level. People want to have sex with attractive partners. And in the kind of environment that we evolved in before contraception, that would just automatically lead to reproduction. But it's not the same as an actual desire to have a baby in terms of what's going on in someone's mind when they are sexually aroused. And if so, indeed, contraception would be the most revolting, repugnant, dangerous thought imaginable. Mm-hmm. It is, because that's not the way evolution works. We don't literally have a desire to make as many babies as possible. We have a desire. That desire is at the ultimate level, and it's a metaphorical desire of the genes. The real desire of the person is to enjoy sex and to cherish babies that you think are your own. And that will automatically lead to reproduction. But it's not the reproduction per se that is the motive in the brain of the person at the time, at that proximate level. And that example then applies to other things like altruism. People confuse the explanation of why people sacrifice themselves for the ultimate benefit of the genes as a kind of cynical debunking of the purity of someone's altruistic motive. And that, too, is a confusion. And we've talked about yet another one when it comes to music.
Yes, thank you. That was very, very well put. You know, when I was reading your book, I thought of a couple analogies. You know, one main point of this book that I thought was great, and you brought in the physicist, his name's Sean Carroll, is that right? Or
yes.
Yes. Yeah. That nature isn't necessarily concerned with human well-being. And that point is excellent. But I think a very related point is that human nature isn't necessarily concerned with human well-being either, you know? And I think both those points are really profound.
Yeah, I think they are essential points, that the laws of the universe don't care about you. So if we want to improve human welfare, we've got to figure out how to do it ourselves, because the universe is indifferent to our well-being. But you're right in pointing out that there's another kind of source of the human tragedy,
yeah,
which is that what was selected in the course of human evolution was not guaranteed to make us either happier or to make us flourish. That is, there are lots of human traits that have a straightforward evolutionary explanation, mm-hmm. but they don't really make us better off in the sense of happier, more harmonious, flourishing. Some do, but we have to take a critical eye at our own psychology to identify which of our traits actually make us better off and should be indulged, and which ones really should be subjects of self-control.
Yes, and I think that brings us to the question of human progress, because it's not encoded in our DNA what an objective list of what human progress would look like. This is something we need to use reason to figure out. Just wanted to take this moment to thank you all for your support of the podcast over the years. It's been a real privilege to do this podcast for you all for over the past 3.5 years. If you'd like to further support the podcast, I wanted to let you know a few things you could do to help make this podcast a better experience for you all. First, I'd really appreciate it if you could subscribe to the Psychology Podcast on iTunes. This would help make the show more prominent on iTunes and increase our listenership. I believe you can subscribe both on your iPhone and on your computer. Second, it'd be great if you could give the show a rating and review on iTunes. I definitely read and appreciate all of the reviews. Another thing you can do is donate some money to the show by going to thepsychologypodcast.com and clicking on the link Support the Podcast at the bottom of the page. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Thanks to the donations we've received so far, we've been able to increase the audio quality substantially. So your donations really do go to helping to make the show a better listening experience. Thanks again for your incredible support of the show over the years. You know, I do this show for you all because I truly love sharing my enthusiasm and love of the mind, brain, and creativity. Okay, now back to the show. First of all, I want to ask, why do intellectuals hate progress so much? And then I want to ask you if you could just list what you see are some of the main indicators of human progress that we all probably should agree on are indicators. Yes.
Well, many intellectuals do hate progress, paradoxically enough, including those who call themselves progressive. Mm-hmm. This is not all intellectuals, obviously. The intellectuals who embrace Enlightenment values do believe in progress. But there is, almost since the Enlightenment unfolded, there's been a counter-Enlightenment, a romantic movement in many intellectuals that actually detests modernity, that looks back to a greater harmony with nature, greater community, that distrusts science as a source of weaponry and pollution, that is not particularly impressed by the well-being of all of humanity, but rather holds out great feats of artistic creation as the ultimate value. And this has always led many schools of intellectual thought, the existentialists, the critical theorists like Adorno and Horkheimer of the Frankfurt School, postmodernism, and Nietzscheanism, to be deeply contemptuous of the notion of progress, and to highlight all the problems that modernity has brought. Why do I think they're wrong? Speaking as a psychologist, I would note is that one can get a misleading impression of the state of the world from the journalism because of the what we psychologists all know of as the availability heuristic. Mm-hmm. We tend to assess risk and probability and danger by memorable examples, and that's what journalism is in the business of giving us. So as long as suffering and misfortune and accidents and violence haven't fallen to zero, they never will, there'll always be examples that that can fill the news. And if that's your source of understanding of the world, then you'd be systematically misled. It's only when you look at data sets that aggregate the wars and the warring nations and the peaceful nations, the homicides that occur and the number of people around who are not murder victims, and plot them over time, that you could even ask the question of whether there's been progress. The fact that bad things happen now doesn't say anything about progress one way or another, because only if you compare the amount of suffering now with the amount of suffering in the past, do you even know which way the sign is, whether it's gone up or down. And I started to appreciate the existence of progress when I became aware of data sets of violence over time, which showed that rates of personal violence, like homicide and rape and assault, have declined in most countries over the centuries and decades. That rates of death in war have plunged since the end of World War II. That barbaric practices like slavery, like execution by torture, such as disemboweling or burning at the stake, such as the application of capital punishment for frivolous misdemeanors like shoplifting, have been eliminated. Even more recently, kinds of violence such as victimization of children in the schoolyard, bullying, sexual abuse of children, physical abuse of children, domestic violence, all in decline when you look at the data as opposed to the remaining incidents. Then for Enlightenment Now, I broadened that to other measures of human flourishing. You can start with some, I guess you call them the big three, being healthy, wealthy, and wise. That is, longevity, hugely increased. For most of human history, it was about 30. Now it is 71 worldwide and more than 80 in developed countries. Prosperity, the global poverty used to afflict 90% of the world's population. Now it applies to less than 10%. And wise, most of history, most people were illiterate. Nowadays, 80% of the world's of the world is literate, 90% of the people under the age of 25.
Well, that I agree, that's progress.
If that isn't progress, what is? Yes.
That's the point, right? But you say that, you know, you list a whole bunch of instances of what you refer to as progressophobia. And I want to pick one because I think it's, in a lot of ways, for me, one of the most interesting ones. So here it is. All your fancy statistics about violence going down doesn't mean anything if you're one of the victims. Now, this is a very interesting one because, and I think it's not so easy out of that one in the sense, I mean, you responded, you said true, but they do mean you're less likely to be a victim. And I think that's a very good point. This is the question I want to ask you is, why should people care about long-term trends over hundreds and hundreds of years when they're only living one short lifetime and what matters most to the individual is their own well-being within that lifetime? Why should they care?
Yeah, well, a lot of these trends apply over the years and decades, not just over the centuries. It's the fact that the rate of violent crime plummeted from 1992 to 2014. The fact that in the lifetime of many people alive today, Germany and Japan were some of the most warlike countries in the history of humanity. Now they're two of the most pacifist countries. But the reduction of extreme poverty is really a phenomenon of the last 30 years or so, at least the steepest plunge. And even increasing lifespans, except for one sector of the American population, but for everyone else, lifespan has gone up in the lives of people living today. I mean, one statistic that I cite from Johan, Advance in Longevity, a person in Kenya over the last few decades has, because lifespan has increased actually faster than living, every day that they get older, they have not approached death by a single day. Mm. That is, a year passes, but Kenyans live a year longer, so they don't even approach death, all of us do, as we age day by day by day. So there are many of these are things that are experienced, that can be experienced within a lifetime.
I really want to nail the point of like, why should certain people, so let's use specific examples. Let's say that you're in the eye of the storm, so to speak. Let's say you're in a extremely poverty-stricken neighborhood. You feel hopeless. You feel like things are really, really tough for you. And I pick up your book and I read it, you know, knowing like, I'll be like, uh-huh, well, at least, you know, it could have been worse if I lived 100 years ago. You know, like, how is that consolation for that individual?
Well, I didn't write the book as consolation for the worst off, but I read it to people who want a view of recent history and of the globe. So it would be a different book if it was directed at, you know, unemployed coal miners in West Virginia.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Even they, admittedly, this requires a feat of reflection and perspective taking, but just knowing that problems are not seemingly intractable, problems may not be intractable. They're not unsolvable. That we've solved other problems. The kinds of advances in education and prosperity and health that have been enjoyed elsewhere can be applied universally. So there's reason for hope, not in the sense of waiting for goodies to arrive, like waiting for Santa Claus, yeah. Hope in the sense that the right kinds of political and economic and social change hold out the promise of improving the lives of everyone, even the ones who are most miserable today. Countries at war can achieve peace. Just this morning, we read that one of the worst ongoing wars in South Sudan might wind down since the leaders have all agreed a peace treaty. Even when I wrote the book, there was the widespread sense that economic growth had flatlined and that unemployment was bound to get worse. But the last year of the Obama presidency and continuing to the present, there's been economic growth and a reduction in unemployment, including a reduction in people who are sitting out of the workforce entirely. So it's often premature to assume that misery will be forever, that problems are intractable, that there's nothing that we can do about them.
Thank you. That was a good answer. And thank you for letting me play devil's advocate. I enjoy doing that. You know, I just like thinking of all the angles. So thank you. It's something I was thinking about now, defending your position now. You know, it occurred to me reading your book that hysteria can be a very dangerous thing to society. So even if you're in the eye of what you think is a storm, it might not actually be a storm, and it might be nice to know that, right? So you have this quote, not every problem is a crisis, a plague, or an epidemic. And among the things that happen in the world is that people solve the problems confronting them. If I had to pick one single line from your entire book, I mean, it'd be hard if I had to just pick one because there are a lot of juicy quotes from your book. But that one in particular, I think, offers a really hopeful perspective, even if you are suffering in this world, to know, you know, because there are a lot of things right now, we could talk about some of those things, that are being painted by the media as a epidemic or a crisis. And you see it in the news over and over again. And just that framing can be very pernicious, right?
I think so. But for one thing, it does feed into kind of radicalism, a desire just to burn the empire to the ground, because anything that rises out of the ashes is found to be better than what we have now, to give up on hopes of reform and improvement. And it can lead to a kind of fatalism, like, well, if we are fortunate, let's just enjoy life while we can, because there's nothing we can do about these intractable problems, and we're doomed anyway. So yes, it is. I was trying to go beyond some of the journalistic cliches of the end of this and the death of that and the dawn of a post-something era, that the crises of the day can often be overcome. They can be surmounted if you have a problem-solving mindset.
So here are a couple things that the news will tell me are epidemics, and which I actually thought were epidemics until I read your book, and now I'm rethinking that, and I want to make sure in this new book I'm working on that I have integrity, that I'm saying it right. So loneliness and suicide are two big ones, and if you type either of those words in Google, you'll get plenty of articles saying that they have reached epidemic proportions. Could you maybe set me straight on that?
Yes. It is undoubtedly true that rates of suicide in the United States have risen since 1999, and all of those hits that you're going to get from Google will use 1999 as a starting point. Because 99 is kind of a local minimum for the suicide rate in the United States. It was the lowest that it had been in several decades. And so it started from a low point. This is not to minimize the tragedy of suicide.
Yeah.
And it has genuinely increased since 1999. Even there, one has to kind of drill down and look where it is happening. And it's not everyone that's committing suicide more often. It is that vulnerable sector of the population that is also been the victim of opioid overdoses, unemployment, dropping out of the workforce. It's largely baby boomer, less educated, more rural men. And so that is a sector of the population that's suffering, and they have been driving up the suicide rate. But it is not an across-the-board phenomenon, and other sectors of the population have seen suicide rate stable or come down. There's generally a rise because a lot of it because of the Great Recession, but when you have periods of high unemployment and often high inflation, economists call it the misery index for a good reason. It does make people miserable, and suicide rates do tend to increase. They were much higher, by the way, during the Great Depression than they are in the wake of the so-called Great Recession. But if one looks at data on suicide over time, one doesn't start the clock in 1999, then one sees that it is not the case that we're suffering from a general suicide epidemic. It really is localized. And for the world as a whole, the Global Burden of Disease Project has shown that suicide rates have come down over the last 25 years.
And then loneliness is another really big one, which is actually sometimes linked to the suicide.
Indeed. And again, there's... you and I in our correspondence had talked about evidence that loneliness is associated with many terrible life outcomes, with reduced health and early death for a number of reasons. That it's close to home because my sister Susan Pinker wrote a book called The Village Effect on the psychological benefits of face-to-face contact and conversely the harms of loneliness. So loneliness is a terrible thing, but it is not true that we're in a sudden new epidemic of increased loneliness. That remember the Beatles song Eleanor Rigby?
Yeah.
Was looking at all the lonely people?
Yeah.
1966. Yeah. And the sociological classic, The Lonely Crowd, by David Riesman, that was in 1952, 53. And the data that I've seen, mainly from Rod Fisher, sociologist at Berkeley, who's done a kind of meta-analysis of surveys of loneliness, says that there have been very little change in loneliness over the decades. This is not to minimize the suffering of people who continue to be lonely. But it's not true that more recent times have seen loneliness skyrocket. Those are two different claims.
Do you think that during the EEA, we were just as lonely? We probably were less lonely because we had smaller tribes, right? And we had greater opportunities for intimate connection and support from people. I don't know. What do you think?
I think that is almost certainly true on average. Everyone knew everyone else. On the other hand, point made by Donald Simons, one of the founders of evolutionary psychology, is that often our most intense feelings and emotions bespeak an evolutionary history where they were uncertain and where there was variation and the consequences of doing without work catastrophic. So why do we never take pleasure in oxygen, but we do take great pleasure in food, even though oxygen is more vital to life in terms of how long you can do without it? He points out that one of the reasons that food is so exquisite when we have it is that very often in evolutionary history, we didn't. It was something that was worth striving for precisely because it was so difficult to get. Likewise, love of children. There were high rates of child mortality. And the reason we treasure our children so intensely is precisely because they were always in jeopardy of perishing, all the more reason to devote effort to their well-being. So this is a speculation. I don't have any anthropological data, but the huge emotional effect of social connectedness and the pain of loneliness might reflect not only that we were typically surrounded by friends and allies, but there probably were times when we weren't, that with social shunning, with ostracism, isolation, probably did occur in our evolutionary history, which is precisely why they are so painful, because a person isolated from a community won't survive long. So I suspect that there was variation even in our evolutionary history.
Yeah, and I really like Leary's work linking it to decrements in self-esteem, you know, the need for belonging and showing how that social protection system works. Like, we're so hyper-attuned to the possibility of rejection that will be sad even at the slightest hint of rejection, but beyond a certain point, it's like an inverted U-shaped curve. Beyond a certain point, like as long as we're like moderately accepted, we don't care if we're very accepted, you know? That makes sense from an evolutionary logic point of view.
That's interesting. What it does suggest is that a certain percentage of the time, rejection and ostracism feel, which is why they're so painful.
It's catastrophic, you know, to be. You know,
emotions for things that are rare, like radioactivity, example, or for many people, exposure to too much sunlight, which gives us a sunburn. We don't feel it it's happening. A lot of things where we don't have negative emotions, where they kind of come in handy. When we do have negative emotions, it suggests that it may have been a very real occurrence in our evolutionary history.
So interesting. Kind of reverse engineer our emotions like that is, you know, to see like that passes, you know, like looking through a microscope at a universe, how many millions of years ago, you know?
It's kind of like that.
I just thought of that on the spot, but it felt like an analogy there. So there's a lot of, as a professor, you know, I hear a lot of talk of the crises on campus, so mental health crisis and rape crisis, but have you looked at data on where those things are crisis? They're obviously important issues and problems, but have they reached epidemic proportions as well?
Well, overall, one thing I discovered to my surprise was that rates of rape nationwide have plummeted since data were first kept in the early 1970s. Now, that was the height of the American crime boom. So we don't know what rates of rape were, say, in the 1940s and 1950s, probably lower. But they have come dramatically down. Rates of sexual harassment are probably down, even though, of course, they're recorded far more often, which is a good thing. One of the reasons, perhaps, that they've been... Now, I don't know about sexual assault on campus, per se, because we don't really have longitudinal data on that. And problem in all data on sexual violence is that definitions can change over time. So, for example, if having sex with someone who is drunk is now considered sexual assault, and that was not true in all times and places. So it's not so easy to compare data at different eras.
And what about the mental health, what's called the mental health crisis? Or, you know, in a lot of ways, I mean, that is linked to the suicide and loneliness things we're talking about.
Indeed. And there are data from Jean Twenge that both depression and anxiety have increased in American college students, although anxiety seems to have leveled off since the 1990s, according to a latest meta-analysis by one of her students. Although the increase in depression, which was the result of a separate cross-temporal meta-analysis, does not indicate a major depression, just measured bouts of depression. And again, a complication there is that over the decades in which Twenge asked those data, the composition of the American student body changed. Far more people went to college, including a huge degree of inclusiveness of people with mental health issues in the first place. It's a little hard to know how much of that increase is due to, say, increased stress of living now compared to earlier decades. I suspect that some of it is real, and at least, and certainly some of the increased things of anxiety from the 50s to the 90s. But by part of it, in any temporal trend, one always has to distinguish three possible causes. One of them being a period effect, the zeitgeist, the changing times, a cohort or generational effect. Some generations are more screwed up than others, being probably the most screwed up generation.
That's a technical term.
And an age effect, namely that people change as they grow up and get old. Mm-hmm. And so if the population is a different mixture of teenagers, young adults, older adults, senior citizens, and so on, then there'll naturally be changes in the average simply because in the case of suicide, for example, the risk of suicide increases with age. So to tease those apart is not always straightforward. And there are indications that my generation of baby boomers kind of pushed the statistics in a bad direction at every stage in our lives. We were more subject to suicide than the cohorts before and after, more subject depression, and that in many ways, for all the ways in which the millennial generation has been maligned, as younger generations go, they're in relatively good shape, at least compared to their baby boomer parents.
So interesting, and thank you for that level of nuance. You know, as a professor like you, you know, I am concerned about what I am hearing, and I'm curious how prevalent it is, and I want to, you know, that helps inform in terms of what my priorities are in terms of helping my students.
Some data suggesting that suicide is lower in millennial teenagers compared to Gen X and baby boomer teenagers. evidence that loneliness has gone down for high school and college students compared to earlier eras. Now, that confounds period with cohort. And unless you have data, repeated data over many decades from people across the age range, it's impossible to distinguish them. But it does suggest that it's better to be a teenager or a young adult in recent years than in years before that. Now, yourself has now kind of sown a new panic about a post-millennial generation, iGen, as she calls them, a controversial claim as well.
Yeah, I was going to say it was no picnic being a teenager in my generation.
Precisely. Well, in general, one quote that I often use in talking about the themes of the book is that the best explanation of the good old days is a bad memory.
Yeah, I loved when you said that, and I really resonated with that. And yeah, you could ask any generation. You know, it's not what my parents would say, like, oh, it was a picnic for us. Well, I thought we should, in the little time we have left, I thought we should talk about the Enlightenment. How about that? Which is actually like the point of your main book. A case, you make a case for reason, science, and humanism. So let me condense a whole bunch of stuff here. So in terms of reason and science, I thought we could talk about politics. That seems to be a very relevant topic nowadays. And the thing that I find interesting is that you talk about, you know, you say in arena after arena, the world is getting more rational, which is a euphemism for better in your worldview, I've noticed. But you do say there is a flaming exception. You say electoral politics and the issues that have clung to it, not necessarily, you know, all these other trends you show in the book have progress, but you're saying there actually is something real here going on that, like, we're not showing progress. If anything, we might be even, what's the opposite of progress?
Regression.
Regression. Yeah. Not regression to the mean, but real regression. No. Yeah.
Yeah.
Below the mean. So could you please tell me about that trend that you've observed?
Well, certainly the, you know, part of that is anecdote driven. The 2016 presidential election, which had in many ways was a carnival of irrationality. I mean, for Donald Trump, not to single out sides, but I'm going to single out a side. But there were, you know, flamingly erroneous beliefs among many of his supporters. There were a contempt for truth-telling, where objective tallies of the number of lies from Trump show that he was the most mendacious presidential candidate in since data were kept. I didn't hurt him. He's our president. So that was the most, granted, that's an N of one.
Not my president, Stephen. No, that's a hashtag called not my president.
Yes, that's right. Yes. That's, unfortunately, technically, yes.
Yeah.
To our great detriment. But, and there are some data that political polarization has increased. That even though a majority of Americans still consider themselves moderate, a greater percentage are on the far left or the far right, and they each one thinks the less of the other in terms of their mental competence and honesty and integrity, if that's a bad thing. There's evidence that presidential debates have gotten stupider over time, and that is longitudinal data. So, you know, again, we shouldn't be fooled by nostalgia. There's plenty of idiocy in earlier elections. But the political arena certainly can't be said to be getting increasingly rational, especially at the presidential level. And there may be a reason for it. I mean, the contrast that I drew, that you alluded to, is that we have in other realms of life a movement toward rationality. In sports, we've got Moneyball and Sabermetrics and other quantitative approaches. In a crime, we've got Compstat and other kinds of data-driven policing that are responsible in good part for the American crime decline. In our medicine, we have more evidence-based medicine. Online, there's the rationality community. In day-to-day governance, there's evidence-based policy and nudge and behavioral insights. In journalism itself, there's fact-checking, like PolitiFact and Snopes. We have Wikipedia, which is a remarkable achievement, all volunteers producing a pretty decent encyclopedia. So in a lot of areas, life has been getting more rational, but our elections have been getting crazier. There probably are features of electoral politics that push toward a certain kind of irrationality that have been noted since the time of Plato, such as that people literally don't have a stake in an election, in the sense that when we talk about people voting against their interests, we're only talking in the aggregate. Since any individual's vote is astronomically unlikely to determine the outcome of an election, in fact, this is a taboo statement. Your vote really doesn't matter. Your vote doesn't matter. Everyone's vote matters. But for each individual, facing the dilemma or the decision of how much of my time should I allocate to becoming cognizant of the issues, should I study the, you know, the details of NAFTA, for right. example?
Yeah.
Well, don't, because they know that it really doesn't make a difference.
Not to even the candidates.
No, well, not even the candidates. That's the scandal.
Yeah.
So voting is kind of, is a form of self-expression. And especially at the federal level, you've got these strange bundles of highly practical policy divides, like tariffs, like highly consequential ones, like nuclear arms control, like climate change. They're often bundled by with emotional hot buttons, like abortion, like wedding cakes for gay couples, where people have an emotional stake in issues that really don't affect them, and they see the franchise as a way of a form of self-expression. So you get competing identities, competing loyalties, competing tribes, rather than the kind of civics textbook idealization of deliberation over the best policies. This is less likely to happen at a local level, where a lot of municipal governments are actually doing pretty well, and people are kind of happy with their mayors. They may not even know which political party their mayor belongs to. But we have not figured a way of closing that gap, getting democracy in the sense that we to apply in this crazy arena of national electoral politics.
Why is it getting so divided? Like, why, I'm seeing this trend as well, but what are the causal factors at play here?
Well, the lazy answer would be social media, because it's the answer to every question about everything that's going wrong.
It's a good answer. Yeah.
Maybe.
It feels intuitively satisfying.
It does. Maybe a little too intuitively satisfying.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
But you know, I suspect if one were to plot the influence, the polarized cable news would probably have a bigger impact. Fox News has been shown actually to push electoral results around in kind of pseudo-experimental studies that compare, say, one town whose cable provider happens to include Fox News and a neighboring one that doesn't.
Yeah.
See, that makes a difference in their elections, and it does. And that antedated social media. Now, social media may have exaggerated it. There have been tendencies. It may also be segregation by profession. We tend to live with people who do the same things that we do in urban areas or in certain kinds of suburbs versus others. So I myself don't have a simple answer to that question. Yeah. Probably no one does.
But you have a solution. I mean, you say here, can we imagine a day in which the most famous columnists and talking heads have no predictable political orientation, but try to work out defensible conclusions on an issue-by-issue basis? Well, that could be a Beatles song. You know, one can only dream that.
Yeah. Well, it is. You know, I can't claim to have a solution, but at least identifying a problem is a start. And I many of us are not even aware that if we identify with the left, as more academics do than the right, we're probably making ourselves less rational just by that very affiliation, simply because the answers, well, we know from studies that people's judgment, including their ability to solve math problems, is warped by their political affiliations. People will make math errors in the direction of their favorite conclusion. So we know from the lab, and we have reason to believe from history, that neither the left nor the right has all the answers to fixing all of society's problems, that we have to be more evidence-based, more issue-by-issue focused, and that an allegiance to one or the other ideology probably makes us less rational. Even if that idea is out there, it may be at least start a little bit of movement to addressing the problem.
For sure. So just real quickly, let's quickly talk about God. No, quickly, religion. So humanism, I'm on board with humanism, but you talk about, can we get a good without a God? You know, can we get these values without a God? Is religion a human need? And I just wanted you to unpack this very, very stimulating statement. You say, don't confuse vulnerability with a need. And I was wondering if you could explain what you mean by that and link it to what a humanistic ethics or humanistic morality could look like.
Yes, well, religions are packages. They're bundles. They're community organizations. They have art. They have culture. They have continuity with the past. They have moralities. And then they have all of these supernatural and theological beliefs. And we have many religions have been kind of quietly unbundling them in a kind of benign hypocrisy where they emphasize their role as community centers or places for moral reflection. And the divine punishment and the archaic Old Testament morality are kind of soft-pedaled. I don't think people have a need to believe in supernatural entities, in a God in the sky, in reward or punishment in an afterlife, in gods of mountains and streams and trees. But we can be lured in that direction because of our theory of mind, our intuitive psychology, our tendency to impute minds to other entities. And in history, a set of beliefs has been bundled together with these community organizations. And it's possible for the organizations to arise without a supernatural creed, and humanist organizations are examples. It's also possible for the legacy religious institutions to downplay the supernatural, but to continue to function as community centers. And that would be a kind of benign hypocrisy that we can encourage. But you don't have to. Believing, as we talked about in the top of the conversation, believing in universal human capacity to flourish or suffer is enough to ground morality. We don't have to have divine commandments or reward and punishment in an afterlife.
Okay. That's a big statement that we could talk about for another 4 hours, but we won't. But I thank you for articulating that position. And, you know, I think a lot about rationality and you kind of equating rationality with the good. And some people might listen to this and think that you're calling for suppression of emotions. And I know you're not doing that, but one could think that's what you're doing in a sense as well when you talk about the counter-enlightenment and romanticism. But, you know, you talk about that earlier in the book about the counter-enlightenment, but then later in the book, you do talk about how, you know, the unification of knowledge across all fields, including the humanities and arts, can be fulfilled only if knowledge flows in all directions. And so it seems to me that really is your core point there, is that you're not talking for some sort of pure rationality, if such a thing even exists, devoid of all emotions. You're saying that there's a lot that we can integrate here. We can integrate the arts, we can integrate even the romanticism, counter-enlightenment, but we can still integrate lots of aspects of human experience, including religious experience, divorced from belief, you know, the actual experience itself, into this worldview that you're of enlightenment values. Is that correct?
Yeah, and there are a lot of, reason doesn't mean asceticism or ugliness or monotony, and there's nothing irrational about falling in love. It may be, you know, irrational, but it's not irrational, or to appreciate the beauty of the world or the comfort of community. But those shouldn't be seen as the antithesis of reason. By any means. It's not, you know, we should all turn into Mr. Spock. So yes, so I don't think we should act irrationally when we set a goal that we're sure of. We should do what's necessary to attain that goal rather than falling back on impulse or superstition. And certainly when it comes to academic disciplines, the humanity, subject matter and the methods of the humanities are absolutely indispensable. And I couldn't have written Enlightenment Now without it, without history, without philosophy, without political theory. But I do think there has to be an integration. There should not be a phobia of data and hypothesis testing within the humanities, nor should there be a wariness of incorporating the best and most recent ideas of human nature into age-old questions like what makes us tick and how is that manifested in our artistic creations and should it affect the design of our political institutions. Those are a feature of the Enlightenment, to get back to the overarching theme of the book.
Yeah.
All those guys, they were philosophers, but they were also intuitive psychologists. And of course, you and I cite them today. We cite Hume on causality and Spinoza on...
quote Nietzsche sometimes. Don't kill me.
Nietzsche, in many ways, was an acute psychologist. And it was really with the more recent professional division of philosophy from psychology that we even think of them as alternatives. Mm. They're not... Psychological claims are not the same as philosophical or normative or conceptual claims. We have to respect the logical distinctions, but they often bear on each other, and that was certainly true in the Enlightenment as the philosophical and points and psychological points were brought to bear on each other. And I think we should see more of it today, despite the somewhat artificial division of knowledge into academic disciplines.
Well, I really love that call for that third culture, right?
Oh.
Yeah. You know, as I read your book, I keep thinking about, wow, there's a good book here that can square the Enlightenment that you're talking about with like modern day notions of Enlightenment. I actually see a correspondence there. And I was wondering, have you ever felt at one with all things in a different sense of Enlightenment?
Yes. And my editor was a little wary of the title.
Sure.
I think it was a book on Buddhism. It is not.
But it's not a book on Buddhism.
Well, maybe not. That may be kind of beyond my skill set to answer the question.
It seems like as we more approach truth, beauty, and goodness, we more approach the feeling of oneness. So I just saw some similarities there.
Robert Wright has made that point.
Yes. Yes. I'm a big fan of Robert Wright.
I'm not sure that Buddhism is true, but it is an argument that he has made.
Okay, fair enough. So I want to end today with a quote that I think summarizes a lot of what we're talking about today. Much of what we call wisdom consists in balancing the conflicting desires within ourselves, and much of what we call morality and politics consists in balancing the conflicting desire among people. Well, thank you for writing such a beautiful book and really having such a call for more harmony in the world.
Thank you, Scott, and thanks for bringing up those very provocative points and asking those penetrating questions. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me, too.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, please add a rating and review of the Psychology Podcast on iTunes. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the podcast, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.